Hello and welcome to the Open Talent Report. This is the podcast where we discuss the emerging trends in labor law, employment law, independent work, and the gig economy, which many organizations are wrestling with due to the growth of the open talent and gig economy. I'm your host, Conor Heaney. When I'm not presenting the podcast, I'm the MD at CXC Global, EMEA, which compliantly connects talent and opportunity.
Hello and welcome to this week's podcast, where I'm delighted to be joined by Suki Belur, CEO and founder of Bench. Suki, I haven't seen you in person, God, coming up to 3 years, I'd say, but 3 years, gee whiz, but it's so good to hear your voice and so good to have you on the show. How the hell are you keeping, my friend? Are you doing well?
Mate, thank you for having me. Yes, it's been an interesting couple of years, couple of years since we met anyway. And obviously the world has changed, so it meant that we couldn't see the people we wanted to sort of see face to face. But it's been a good journey last couple of years. So we're sort of fighting through, and we'll keep going.
Excellent. Well, listen, we're looking forward to hearing more. But my suspicion is that the bench is entering the right place, right time moment, given all that's happened during the course of the 2 years. So I'm really looking forward to hearing about your platform in more detail, and of course our listeners too, Suki. So, Suki, what's the Suki Pop Quiz? How did you arrive at becoming a CEO and founder at Bench, which is a technology platform? What was your journey, and would you be prepared to share that with our listeners?
Sure. I mean, I can certainly say it wasn't planned. So, like many pre Y2K in the UK, I sort of I stumbled into the world of recruitment. And back then, I actually had no idea that recruitment was even a thing. So I spent a couple of years with one of the large specialist IT recruiters. In 2000, I then moved to Australia and joined another recruitment business. But always from a very young age, I'd had this thing in me that was like, you know, you're going to have your own business one day. So in 2002, an opportunity presented itself, and I sort of launched my own recruitment business. And right from the get-go in that business, I was always focused on trying to come up with ways that were probably a bit more innovative than what our competitors were doing in terms of how they delivered the services. And then 1 year I decided that, you know what, I'm going to disrupt my own agency. And so that was around sort of 2011. And we'd sort of created the notion of Bench. And that was based off the back of a conversation we'd had with a customer. And it sort of, the idea presented itself and then sort of grew from there. And then sort of around 2016, 2017, I thought, you know what? Whatever we built, I think there's a world for it, there's a market for it. And so we sort of, you know, shut down the old business and sort of focused my attention on building essentially a software business, which, it's had its challenges because it's not building a recruitment business, but it's been fun anyway.
Yeah, and Suki, I hadn't intended to ask this, but your response got me thinking, and I delved into this with Christopher Dwyer from Arden Partners on our last show. He's a bloody legend, as many of our listeners and you will appreciate and know. But it got me thinking about my own days in recruitment. Like yourself, Suki, started my career in IT recruitment staffing, working niche investment banking, and you know, if you're good at it, which it sounds like you were, if you had your own agency, and you know, I was relatively decent at it, Suki, it can provide a very good lifestyle and living. But it always frustrated me, and I always described myself, and I hate this term, as the thinking man's recruiter back then, because it used to really frustrate and annoy me that the process was so convoluted that essentially you're almost. This sounds really crude, Suki, but you're almost treating people, contractors, as barrels of oil. Essentially, they knew that they were a commodity and you were essentially brokering those people as a commodity, right? Now, that's the simplest way I could describe it. And I was asking Chris, and I'll ask you this same question, Suki. it always struck me that there was never this big bang moment in recruitment, the same way that there was a big bang moment in the stock market in the 1980s. So in the 1980s, everyone's seen, you know, Wall Street or films like that, where you've got these huge open outcry trading pits. You know, the big bang technology pretty much eliminated that. So you had more sophisticated traders in hubs, you know, trading through their computers. And it struck me that recruitment was always overdue, that right? It was ripe for that form of disruption. So I suppose what my question really is, do you think recruitment has evolved much since you're running your own agency? And also, if you look at IT staffing, how it's done today in the IT contracting world, is it really any different than what it was in the early 2000s or the you know, 2010 or 2006 when I was starting? What's your view, Suki?
Look, I would say the short answer is no, it hasn't. And I think there's a number of reasons for that. It's become so big as an industry. It's become so ingrained into the fabric and the DNA of the organization that is looking for talent that we've sort of, over time, I think the inefficiencies that exist today and also the same inefficiencies that existed back in the day, I don't think any of them have really been removed. And I think that's a part of the problem because it is still very inefficient. The customer just wants an end result. They just want the resume that they can now go and, you know, fill the job that they need to fill with. But the actual steps required to go and find that one person, it doesn't matter whether you've got an ATS or a LinkedIn or job boards or whatever. All they do is they generate volumes of resumes, and ultimately somebody's got to go and filter through them. And yes, we've got AI evolving now to sort of, you know, go trawl through resumes and pick out your shortlist. But ultimately, AI today certainly cannot pick out the winner amongst a batch of people as well as a human can do. So I think, you know, the agencies had sort of embedded themselves so well into these organizations by providing this labor themselves, i.e. the recruiters, to go and do all of the heavy lifting. But the problem also is that the organization engaging that agency only gets to pay when there's a winner, like when there's a person that's filled a job, right? So for them, it's like, okay, we'll get three agencies to do it because we'll cover the market and we'll get the best candidate. And all that does is it drives up the cost of actually doing business because, you know, for every three agencies that are working on a job, only one's going to fill it, but the other two, it's cost them money to actually go and fill or try to fill that job. So on the next job, when they win, they're not only covering the cost of doing that job, but they're covering the cost of doing the jobs that they lost. So the prices have remained high, or the fees remain high. There's not been much tech to sort of manage that workflow simply because it does really require human intervention to sort of manage the process to pick out those good candidates. So I think it's lasted as long as it has, but I do think we're at a point now where the industry itself is being challenged by, you know, its customer base to say, you know, you need to be able to come up with different ways to do this because, Mr. Agency, we also, as the employer, have access to exactly the same candidates you do. What's the value you're now going to provide to us that will stop us doing this all of ourselves? So I do think, I think the world is changing, but I think up until now, there's been plenty of reason for everybody just to let the status quo remain the status quo.
Yeah, you're right. Okay. My suspicion is, and you and I have probably been through a number of what I would describe as hiring super cycles. I mean, this isn't the first war for talent, right? It's one of a number of wars going back over many years. But I think, you know, in a market like this where there's scarce candidates and tons of jobs available from enterprise customers or medium-sized enterprises, anyone can be successful, right, in recruitment in a weird way, right? I know that sounds quite trite, right? But if you're willing to put yourself out there, get a few jobs on and you can go and fill them. But I think when the tide goes out and the economy gets a bit tighter and the war for talent maybe diminishes somewhat, that a lot of the agencies that might have popped up over the last 5 to 7 years and maybe over the last 2 to 3 years are gone. And I've seen that happen so yeah, many times, unfortunately. But it strikes me, though, Suki, if we just look at this topic for a moment, and as I said, I hadn't really intended it, but there's almost two problems here as I see it. One, there's the sort of old school way of recruiting, the bricks and mortar or virtual remote recruitment companies that do a very valuable job, in fairness to them. You know, I've worked with some amazing and still work with some amazing recruitment companies, and they do a phenomenal job for the client and oftentimes in the client's best interest. But if you think how that process can be improved, and you've touched on that in some detail there, Suki, which is great. But the other part of the problem in my mind is that the end client, if you like, the enterprise, the large enterprise, the medium-sized enterprise, they come to the market late, right? Because they don't know how to do resource demand planning or capacity planning well, right? Because oftentimes, you know, if you think of, you know, a large telco company, right, that's selling infrastructure to the enterprise, you've got all these sales guys going out and banging in deals, right? And then they come to get the deal signed, and then it comes to implementation and getting that service or that infrastructure in life, and then you need a customer support mechanism to support it. So there's all these hundreds of roles that have suddenly popped up for this organization. They're going, Jesus, how the hell do we do this? So it strikes me that there's a disconnect between the end user, the enterprise, going to market late because they haven't tackled the resource demand or capacity planning problem correctly. And then you've got a somewhat, at times, broken process with many different parts in it to actually solve that supply of labor or people problem. Would you agree with that, Suki, or is it more nuanced than that simple description?
No, I would say that's it's a big problem, and I think you've sort of articulated the problem very well. Just to sort of touch on the other part of the conversation was, I think, so a few years ago, maybe a decade ago, in my mind, the traditional recruitment space was already changing in terms of it was polarizing between the small specialist recruiters and then the large scale, you know, mass recruiters. And I think that's where we're at today. And I think there is value in an agency at those two extremes. So where you've got, you know, a large employer with lots of requirements in lots of locations, they need someone that's got a global footprint or a national footprint to help them solve their recruitment challenge, because internally it's probably too complex to sort of set up. And then I think at the other end, you've got the small niche players where you've got the, you know, the hardcore specialist recruiters who do, you know, things in the old school way, and they actually go out and search for the people that you need. And so I think there'll always be a home for the agency market. But I think touching on your second part of the point that you raised, I think the world is changing and it's becoming way more connected. Connected in that the scenario you described around, you know, sales guys are out there selling their wares to an end customer somewhere else, right? So it could be, you know, a systems integrator is selling its services into an airline. The airline and the sales guys are talking about a deal, and this thing goes on and on and on for weeks, possibly months. And then snap, someone signs a purchase order and goes, right, we're ready to go. And I think that's where the problems are, because there's a disconnect between the impact that that is now going to have on the ability for that systems integrator to now go and deliver that outcome. And so typically what happens is, you know, this, all these requisition orders go into a VMS somewhere. A bunch of suppliers get notified of, you know, a bunch of requirements that they now need to go and fill. And everyone's now scrambling around to try to find those candidates to fill those roles. Yeah. But the problem here is that the agencies are so downstream that they've A, had no visibility of what the customer really wanted, and B, they weren't really engaged early on in the process to be able to go, actually, You're not going to get a BA at $900 or $700. You're not going to get one of these, or, you know, the ideal combination will be one of these from here and one of those from there. There's no engagement. And I think what is changing out there is that systems integrator is expecting more now of its suppliers and partners. And I think that change will shift the dynamic for agencies and or the provision of talent, because I think it's going to have to be a lot more integrated. It's going to have to play a role further upstream within that organization, so it's considered a real partner, a real supplier, so that they can actually help maybe even shape the solution that's being sold to the end customer, so that when it gets signed off, it's more seamless. So I think we are at a major transition point.
Yeah, I agree with you, Suki. I really like that analysis and viewpoint, and I certainly subscribe to it. And Suki, I'm sorry for taking us on that segue, but I just couldn't help myself asking that particular question, given your background. But I think what you've just described there, Suki, leads us nicely onto this, which is, what are the problems and or challenges that the Bench platform is solving or attempting to solve?
Yeah, actually a good segue from what we've just spoken about. Me personally, a few years ago, I could start to sort of see that ability to integrate more closely with the demand cycle within an organization, and then map that to your capability network was going to be something of importance and interest, especially within that sort of ICT vertical, which is really where we play and have always played. So in terms of, you know, where we sort of come in and the challenge we're trying to solve is in the scenario I sort of described before, where you've got that systems integrator, they're talking to an end customer somewhere. Gone are the days where the end customer would go to a particular provider and say, hey, look, I know you're good at doing A and B, so here's a project that involves A and B. That was easy, right? They could then sort of, you know, go and get their people and do whatever they needed to do. But the world is different today. The end customer is going to the SI and saying, I need you to solve this problem, and it's going to require, we think, A, B, C, D, and E, but it may also require more. Can you do it? And because of the competition, the provider is reluctant to walk away, and salespeople generally are reluctant to walk away. Yes. So the challenge then becomes is, if they're saying, yes, we can do this, knowing full well that they can only do components of it, how do you now go and fill those gaps? And if you start to look at the world as from the perspective of the organization, if they could tap into different channels simultaneously and go and explore what capability exists internally, what capability exists within our talent pool, what capability exists within our supplier network and our partner network, so that they could actually very quickly and very easily and very efficiently say back to the customer, yes, Mr. Customer, we can do all of those components that you've asked us to do. Here's a potential solution, and here's a potential price. Now, in this scenario, if the customer says, we love what you've done, here's the purchase order, the SI has already engaged its entire ecosystem early in the sales cycle. They may not have known who the end customer was, but they certainly know that something was coming up, and they've been involved in the input in how that was going to be ultimately delivered, or not delivered necessarily, but certainly resourced. So in that scenario, you've got a situation where the end customer is happy, the SI is happy, the suppliers are happy, because there's no surprises, right? They've had an input into a BA will cost this, or this is not possible, that's not possible. And so that's really where we built the platform to solve a problem for. It provides that almost like that orchestration layer to allow an organization to connect its ecosystem internally and externally of all the capability that exists, bring it all into the one place so that they're able to have complete visibility of what they can do. They've got visibility of what they can't do and therefore can go and fill those gaps. And they can engage that ecosystem very early on in the sales cycle so that they can increase their chances of actually going to win a deal and therefore deliver an outcome to their customer.
Wow, Suki, I love that particular detailed description of what Bench does and what you guys solve for. And I really like that phrase, Suki, the orchestration layer. I don't think I've heard that before. And I think it more than adequately sums up the benefit of what your platform can do. And, you know, going back to that right place, right time comment at the beginning of the show, It strikes me that this probably is your time, given all that's going on. You know, the system integrators and the large enterprises are going gangbusters in digital transformation, infrastructure, telco, the move to Microsoft Teams and cloud enabled remote working through enabled through the cloud. So I can see why you guys are very well positioned, Suki, to grow and to solve that particular problem. And if I think back to my own career, providing resources into the system integrator world, they would have bitten my arm off 10 years ago. I'm thinking back to my days working with the likes of British Telecom and various large infrastructure providers. They would have bloody loved this. So I can see the huge attraction of working with your platform, Suki. And Suki, thanks for taking the time to walk our audience through that. So Suki, I think moving on then, we'd like to look at something that's been described by the World Employment Confederation, Bloomberg, the Financial Times and The Economist as labour market paradox. And essentially, they picked up on this paradox at the beginning of 2021. But in short, what they're saying the labour market paradox is, as a result of the pandemic or during the course of the pandemic, millions of people lost their jobs. I think at one point there was nearly 400 million people unemployed or on some sort of government subsidy. But yet at the same time, around the end of 2020, beginning of 2021, most enterprises, whether it's large or medium, if you exclude hospitality and aviation, just for obvious reasons, but most sectors of the global economy went on this hiring bonanza, right? And so what you've got is you've got huge unemployment coupled with huge demand for workers, right? So that's in short the labour market paradox. So my question really is twofold, Suki. The first is, why do you think this has arisen, this paradox? And two, in your view, and I know you're not a magician, Suki, but in your view, what can be done to solve for this particular problem or paradox?
Yeah, so look, I think I think the way we look at talent and or capabilities needs to change. So I think if we're looking at a project, I think we can all agree that, you know, a project needs talent to deliver it. And again, you know, it could be an IT project, it could be an engineering project, regardless of industry sector, it requires, you know, talent to deliver it. But when I think we talk about talent, we typically start to think about either contingent talent or permanent talent. But really, in my mind, what the project owner is looking for are a set of capabilities. And I think when we start to think about this in the way of procuring or sourcing capability, I think it starts to open up new ways in which we can actually think about things. So you take the typical organization, you know, they're already very familiar with procuring talent through an MSP or going directly to agency suppliers or going to a talent marketplace. But when you step inside the shoes of the customer, it's actually a highly fragmented process for them. And it also, I think, discards other valuable sources of capability, namely that of, you know, service partners and remote workers. And I think, you know, what we've seen in the last couple of years is a total dismantling of what we think work is and how we think work is delivered or can be delivered. You know, we've all firsthand now lived through the largest experiment in history on working from home, right? And, you know, people now understand that you can have your workforce, whether direct or indirect, you know, working from home remotely. So I think we have to start to think about the way we look at talent differently so that we can start to look at ways in which we can go and attract talent through different channels. But it's now going to be, and I think it will always be, a mix of how we bring all of that together and our openness to actually start to think about alternate options to how we can get work done. And I personally think, the world is moving towards more outcome-based work as opposed to time and material type engagements. And I think even in the employment sector, organizations will start to think about, you know, projects and outcomes that they need delivered, and therefore how can those projects and outcomes now be delivered? You know, does it have to be by a person sitting at a desk in a certain city, in a certain office location? Or can it be done by a team that is comprised of, you know, some contingent workers, some internal staff, some service providers, some remote workers? And I think once the organization, I think, can get its head around the fact that there are now multiple channels for it to go out and actually engage capability and bring that capability together and then get that capability to deliver an outcome, I think, me personally, I think it becomes way more inclusive of the different types of capability that exists out there. So I think the paradox has to now be solved by changing the way organizations view the talent and or capability and changing the way in which that capability is accessed, brought together, and then enabled to go and deliver these outcomes.
Mm-hmm. Sounds like they need a conductor to bring that orchestration layer to together, Suki, if not a conductor, a platform. Thanks for that, Suki. And Suki, I just want to look at something briefly. I hadn't intended to discuss this. We talked a lot on the show about direct sourcing, and we went into it in a huge amount of detail with Christopher Dwyer, and he had some really interesting stats about enterprises' plans to adopt direct sourcing in 2022, which actually surprised me, because there seemed to be quite a positive uptake in relation to direct sourcing plans. But my question is a really simple one, Suki. It might not provoke a simple answer, though. But in your view, Suki, is direct sourcing one of many silver bullets to solve the talent scarcity problem? Or is it just a fad that many people in our sector are talking about because it sounds like the best thing since sliced bread?
Look, I think direct sourcing comes with its own set of challenges. You know, for an organization to go out and direct source, A, it needs the connectivity into the sources, and B, it needs the manpower and or technology to help, you know, aggregate, vet, and bring that talent in to a pool so that they can go and now source it directly. I think, you know, over the last, 24 years I've been sort of in the world of recruitment in one shape or another. I think, you know, these sort of peaks and troughs of demand and sort of life cycles bring in different sort of terms and different sort of offerings. And I think, you know, direct sourcing, does it mean just cutting the agency out and going to your direct talent pool? Well, if that's the definition of an organization's view on direct sourcing, then I think that has its own set of challenges. And I think, you know, in the past, the MSP has sort of, you know, the agencies evolved themselves into the MSP and into the RPO. You know, they all had their place and time. You know, in my mind, the MSPs are probably being challenged at the moment. You know, the RPOs have always been challenged. There's always been a cycle between, you know, we are now going to appoint an RPO. Now, actually, the RPO has done its great job. We can do this ourselves, get rid of the RPO. 3 or 4 years later, the RPO comes back. And I think there's always that cycle. And I think direct sourcing is just is another play at the moment around organizations, especially in our industry, trying to figure out their next level of relevance to what I think is now a highly dynamic customer base that is actually driving real change. And I think this sort of loops back to your opening comments around, you know, our industry hasn't really felt any sort of seismic shifts, but I think we're now in that. And I think, you know, direct sourcing is an attempt to sort of say, hey, Mr. Organization, you can sort of have your own direct sourcing model, but it still requires manpower to build and manage and deploy. So, you know, does that mean that the traditional recruitment agencies, either the ones that are in the MSP space or not, are now sort of repositioning themselves to take advantage of this new wave and actually go and build these talent pools for the organization to sort of really help them sustain a role for themselves? It's a good question, and I guess time will tell, but I think, you know, organizations already have access to direct talent pools. Yes. But again, it's the manpower that's required to go and manage those or access them or maintain them that is causing the organization its problem. And I think, you know, the agencies will step in and go, hey, we'll do that for you.
Yeah, I think it's a great opportunity for the agency, the MSP, the labor intermediaries, and of course some a lot of the digital labor platforms that have come into the market. And I agree with you. I think it's both an offensive and a defensive position, and of course to address a real need, which is organizations can't always get the talent that they need. But here's something, Suki, I want to look at. You know, this sector that I'm about to talk about, and I'd love to hear your views on, for me there's real seismic disruption potential from this sector, which is the public freelance talent marketplace, which, Jesus, sounds like really convoluted, but if I can describe some of the companies that operate in this space. So you've got freelancer.com, I think are the largest by either market cap or workers on their actual platform. I think it's in the region of, they've got around 65 million people on their platform. Now, according to the most recent statistics that I've seen from the International Labour Organization, and I don't have the recent quarterly figures from freelancer.com in front of me, but I think last year on the ILO report, there was around 100,000 workers deployed at any time, right, in freelancer.com. So in percentage terms, it's probably not huge. Now, I'd love to see what those figures look like now, but you've got freelancer.com in this space, you've got Upwork, you've got Fiverr, who recently acquired Stoke Talent, you've got People Per Hour, these essential public talent marketplaces. So I'm interested in your view on whether they have sufficiently evolved their offering to work directly with the large enterprise to solve the talent problem. And I'm coming at this question, Suki, really around the governance, compliance and risk that large enterprises typically care about. You know, have the platforms that I've mentioned and others, of course, sufficiently evolved their delivery model and operating model to remove some of the governance, compliance and risk challenges? Do you think they're there yet? And do you think they have a role to play in solving the talent marketplace problem? And then the third question, Suki, is, are they going to disrupt what the typical recruiter or MSP company does, in your view?
Okay, so look, I think if we're coming at it firstly from, you know, whether they've got a role to play, you know, working with the enterprise to solve that talent scarcity, I think if you look at most of these public talent marketplaces, they've scaled by allowing contractors to join these marketplaces through essentially a self-serve model, right? Which basically means anyone can join. So that's highly beneficial to the marketplace owner. You know, the stat you talked about, freelancer having 65 million. The only way you can get to those sorts of numbers is by actually just opening the floodgates and saying, hey, anybody that is a freelancer that wants to offer their services can come and join our marketplace. But what that means for the enterprise searching for the talent is they have to now go through a whole bunch of profiles to actually go and find the needle in the haystack.
Yes.
And so in my mind, there becomes no difference then between them doing that and sticking a job up on Seek or Monster. So I think there's a challenge there today, because I think at a moment in time when they first launched, I think, yes, it was just another avenue. But I think if you look at the challenges that organizations are now facing, I think it's potentially another headache for the enterprise to go in and go and access that particular market. So I think the value in a freelance marketplace, and I'll use the term freelance marketplace as opposed to a public freelance marketplace.
Yes.
I think it exists if the marketplace owner is responsible to some degree for vetting each and every applicant. Now, you know, we know this is very resource intensive, and it ultimately drives up the cost of acquisition per candidate that sort of enters into this marketplace. Having said that, I think there's a definite use for these marketplaces for aggregating particularly scarce and specialist capabilities like cybersecurity, for example.
Yes.
Where I think there's an opportunity is basically a hybrid model. So something between a marketplace platform where you've got the provider and maybe an operator. And the operator is becomes a part of this converged solution stack to the end customer. So now what we have under this model is the operator of this marketplace would take the role of actually being the regulator and sets and manages the benchmarks basically people have to meet to be invited into this marketplace or accepted into this marketplace. And then what we have is essentially we're talking about a private labeled marketplace created specifically for an enterprise. And so I think it's looking at this sort of direct sourcing model combined with a freelancer marketplace, combined with somebody taking responsibility for sort of vetting and being basically an operator of that. And so I think where the benefit of all of that is, for that large enterprise, what they're getting access to is a vetted community of contractors, which they can now go and tap into a lot quicker. Because you and I both know from our days in recruitment, essentially, it's a time game, right? So
yes.
You know, to nurture all the things that we as agencies and recruiters did in the past, we were being paid for our time, because when an employer was looking for somebody, they didn't have the time to go and stick an ad up on wherever and sort of, you know, go back to their network of people and ring around and do all the things that we so thanklessly did so that we could get, you know, a resume in front of them by that afternoon or by tomorrow morning. That's what they were paying us for, really. And the one who could get the best candidate in front of them the quickest was ultimately the winner.
Yeah.
But I think if you take it in the context of where the world is at now in the freelancer marketplaces, I think, again, I think if you look at, you know, where we are going as a human race, you know, we used to be very closed off. There wasn't, you know, really many ways in which we could get a hold of each other. Then in the last sort of decade or so, everything has become open, and all of our data and privacy is sort of not private anymore. And I think the world's going back to wanting to be closed off again, but closed off in the communities that it wants to be a part of. And I think there's a parallel there between what is happening in our world in that context and the world of recruitment, because I think, you know, open freelance marketplaces had their time, but again, quality is an issue. So I think they'll start to close down, and I think they'll become more specialist. There'll be people operating them, there'll be people managing them, and there'll be people providing them, so that the benefit to the end customer is a much higher quality resource delivered in a time frame without messing around, so that I, as the employer, can tap into this marketplace, find the talent that I want, engage it, and then move on to the next project.
I like that, Suki. And that operator piece that you mentioned, Barry Matthews from Open Assembly Struck Resource Group describes it as the ETL translation layer between the enterprise and the marketplace. And I think that, you know, the operator model, I think, accurately describes that too. Suki, I agree with you. I think there's a role for companies or a company to play in terms of that translation or operating piece to give the enterprise that assurance and reassurance that the talent that they're getting from the marketplaces, the freelance marketplaces, are vetted, are quality assured, and can do the job that they say they can do or want them to do. So I really like that that rationale that you've outlined there, Suki. And Suki, we're going to move into a bit more of the future and a bit more into the esoteric, if you like. So just bear with me, please. So this question, it always makes me chuckle because it's so bloody ridiculous. But if you had a magic wand, what one labor law would you change and why?
So just labor laws or just...
Or any.
Something about the labor market.
Yeah, actually, let's expand it, Suki.
Yeah, cool. Okay, with my magic wand. I think technology has made it easier to connect employers with those looking for work, right? I think everyone would agree with that. And I think, you know, up until as recently as sort of 10 years ago, the only real choice that employers had was to sort of, you know, stick an ad up on a job board somewhere. And so today, I think we have so many more channels to sort of go and attract and source labor through. But I think with the emergence of each new channel, what we're creating for the enterprise or the organization is basically a new process and a new process to go and access that talent pool. And I think although the technology is making things easier, by giving us more and more choices, it's actually making it very inconvenient and very time consuming for the employer. So with my metaphorical magic wand, I would sort of provide a gateway and a gateway for organizations to go and access all of these different channels and give the user a very simple, easy way to find exactly what they're looking for when they need it. That's a big wand, I think.
That is, but I mean, we're in the sphere of the aspirational, Suki, now, so it's all good. You're amongst friends, so thank you for that, Suki. And Suki, I just want to touch on your views on remote working. Do you think it obviously has a role to play at the moment, but, you know, hopefully as we move to a post-pandemic world, we might get some sort of normality into our working lives. Although remote working for many is the new normality or new abnormal, depending on your viewpoint. But in your view, Suki, what's its role, and do you feel that it's here to stay?
So fundamentally, I think the whole remote working thing is about democratization. So I think I mentioned earlier, you know, in the last couple of years, you know, we've all undergone this huge work from home experiment. And I think, you know, again, most would agree that the overwhelming majority say that, you know, people can now work from pretty much wherever they want to, as long as, you know, what needs to be delivered gets delivered. So I think for the employer, it gives them access to skills which up until now may not have actually been available in their locality. Or if they were available, they might have been available at a very high price point. And then I think if you flip that coin over, on the other side of that coin, there's a whole world of talent that essentially had its earning potential limited by their local market. And I think what platforms that are now connecting, you know, the employer with remote workers are doing is actually creating this genuine win-win for all parties, because through this democratization, talent that was maybe undervalued in a particular geography can now receive value more commensurate with what the rest of the world is thinking about paying. For the employer, I can now get access to talent that maybe didn't exist locally. And I think, you know, that sort of balancing out of supply, demand, and price points and availability and all the other things that go with it, I think will mean that the remote working model will certainly remain with us.
Yeah, Suki, I fully agree with you. I love that description, that democratization of work. I think it really, remote working really has the opportunity to level that playing field as much as possible and afford access of opportunity to all. You know, I always use this thing in my mind, you know, the software developer in San Francisco on, you know, 200 to 300 or half a million US dollars a year, you know, the same talent as good as, if not better, exists elsewhere in the world. I'm thinking Poland, I'm thinking Ukraine, I'm thinking Latvia, Estonia, Bulgaria, Hungary, the list goes on, of course, down in the Asia as well, but obviously focused on Europe. But, you know, the similar sort of skill set can be achieved in Poland for maybe less than 100K in euros, maybe around the 60K mark. So you could maybe pay a Polish person or someone in Poland or in Eastern Europe 100K euros and bring them up within their own local environment and afford them that access to opportunity, but also increase their earning potential. It might not be initially the half a million that the software developer in San Francisco gets, but it's certainly better than what they might achieve in the local market when there was constraints around where and how you could work. So I think remote working and the pandemic has effectively broken those constraints, those border constraints, and has afforded that democratization, I'm finding that difficult to say, Suki, and access to opportunities. Yeah, so I fully, it is, I need another coffee, it sounds like, but I tell you, Suki, I'm enjoying this conversation, and I agree with your thoughts entirely on remote working. And Suki, I want to finish, if I may, with a question that we ask all of our guests, and it might seem trite, but I know we've talked a lot about the future, but what is your one prediction or predictions for the future of work?
So I would say the prediction I would make is the emergence of platforms that actually provide access to what we call sort of ecosystems of aggregated capability and opportunity, right? So I think the future will be where the user has a single entry point and they get the convenience and choice to both the enterprises looking for capabilities and those providing them. And I think through this, we'll be able to experience and take advantage of this convergence of capabilities that we've been talking about. And I think if you look at the B2C space, it's already occurred, right? So you've got the likes of Amazon, eBay, and Alibaba. You know, if you're looking for a widget and you go on to Amazon, you don't have to then, you know, and then you want sort of to buy, a hairdryer. You don't then go somewhere else. You just, you know, you're within that ecosystem and you're now going to go and buy essentially whatever it is that you want to go and buy. So I think my future prediction is the emergence of ecosystems and platforms for capability or services, whereby, you know, the user needs to go and find a whole bunch of different capabilities in their various forms. They'll have platforms that allow them to sort of provide the connectivity, single entry points, and this world of capability will be in front of them. And equally on the other side, the talent itself, in its many guises and forms, can be in these ecosystems and actually go and find opportunity, not only in their own backyard, but, you know, anywhere on the planet. And so I think that's really where I see this whole future of work heading?
Wow, I really like that future that you've outlined there, Suki. And Suki, I've thoroughly enjoyed our conversation today.
Likewise, mate.
I really appreciate you coming on the show, and you really come at things from a very interesting and relevant and rational angle, Suki, and I really appreciate your time today. So, Suki, thanks again. Where is the best place for our listeners to find you or seek you out?
I'm on LinkedIn, or you can visit us at bench.team, and you can sort of find me through there.
Wonderful. Well, Suki, thanks so much. Have a great day ahead, and really enjoyed the show. Catch up soon, mate.
Thanks for your time, mate.